Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is the United States versus White et al. Mr. Sannon.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nishay Sannon. I represent defendant Felicia Ford in this appeal. As your honors are aware, this was a scheme to defraud based on mail and wire counts under 1343 and 1342. Ms. Ford was a closing agent for a company called Title Zone. The scheme that's alleged in the indictment and was evidence was presented at trial was based on a buyback program through mortgage fraud. We've raised several issues before the court. The two that I want to focus on, unless this court has questions on the other issues, is one, whether or not the scheme to defraud was actually complete before Ms. Ford gets involved in the distribution of the proceeds of that scheme. And there's case law from both the United States Supreme Court and other circuits that indicate that if the scheme to defraud is complete, the wire or mail fraud is complete, the distribution of the actual proceeds does not count as part of the scheme to defraud because the money is already theirs.
But I have to say, Mr. Sannon, that this scheme, as alleged in the indictment and as proved at trial, had to include the completion of the closing process on the real estate transactions at a minimum. I'll put to one side the bankruptcy fraud issues for Mr. Helton. So assume, I don't have any big quarrel with the theoretical proposition you say, but it seems to me on the facts here, it's abundantly clear that the scheme necessarily included the formal real estate closing. And if that's true, then your client's acts of creating the counterfeit cashier checks and cutting and pasting things together and preparing the phony HUD-1 forms is part of the scheme.
Well, with all due respect as to the facts in this case, what happens is the banks approve the loans based on the applications.
But the approval of the loan is nothing until there's a closing.
That's not true, Judge, because the wire transfer takes place upon the application. The proceeds are sent to Title Zone, which is who Ms. Ford works for.
Well, I disagree with you, actually. I think, you can transfer things to a title company as an intermediary, but until there's a closing, nothing happens. And then should the closing fall apart for some reason, all the title company is doing is holding things as an escrow agent. It could return it to the original payor. It could do whatever it wanted. This required the closing.
Well, Judge, the title company could have actually distributed the funds, if you look at the record, before what the banks required in the closing actually took place. Ms. Ford wasn't the one who decided when the proceeds were distributed. It was actually her boss at Title Zone. And there was, and
but
the evidence.
She's phonying up the whole thing. I mean, I don't know if a jury could have ruled in her favor, but this jury was persuaded by the government's evidence that she was part of this scheme.
Well, Judge, they actually found her not guilty in two counts. And the two counts they actually found her not guilty are the only two counts that had the double HUDs that the government alleges. So this whole double HUD theory that the government alleged in those seven counts she was charged, there was only double HUDs in two of those counts. And those two counts, the jury actually found her not guilty. So to say that she created these false documents that led to conviction, those counts she was actually found not guilty. It was the other several counts in which she was found guilty, in which she was the closing agent. And, Judge, if you look at the Supreme Court case law, once the proceeds are in the hands.
I don't read the Supreme Court cases that way, actually. But the government has alleged a scheme which is a number of steps. As I look at this scheme, people just specialized in it. Ford did certain things, Helton did certain things, White did certain things, and that's not at all uncommon in a scheme to defraud.
No, it's not uncommon that every actor has a part in that scheme, but when does that scheme end is the question. There has to be a point when the scheme ends. It's our position that that scheme ends as soon as the wire transfer and the money is in the hands of Title Zone, because it could be argued very clearly, and I think the evidence at trial showed that the owners of Title Zone were unindicted co-schemers in this thing.
The scheme, doesn't work unless title to the property has shifted to these other people, the so-called investors, and the equity is stripped out of the house.
Well, I disagree, Judge. The scheme is done when the people who are committing the fraud actually get the money. If this is a true scheme, Those people don't care if title transfers. All they want is their money. And that money is already sent into a co-conschemer's bank account and then just distributed based on the so-called closing. So the scheme is done at that point. The facts indicate that money is transferred from New York or Ohio, who are the new funding banks, to Title Zone. The evidence during the trial showed, and Ms. Jepson, I believe, who's one of the owners of Title Zone, and there was plenty of testimony that they let all these closings go through, even if one of these closing checks weren't presented at the closing, or if certain documents were missing. All the closings took place. What Ms. Ford did was facilitate the distribution of the funds of the fraud, or the scheme to defraud. Because, as this Court is aware, there's a scheme, and then there's a date on which the wire transfer took place.
Why don't you comment on the evidence that the government reviews on pages 13 and 14 of its briefs? What it says, if you don't have it right in front of you, it says, in her role as closer, she facilitated the fraud scheme in several ways. She accepts the cashier's checks provided by White, even though she knows that White had funded and provided them, and the names are false. She presents the cashier's checks to the lenders, fraudulently representing that these investors had provided equity. She creates counterfeit cashier checks. She cuts and pastes together these checks and faxes them to lenders, and she provides EHNS with its payoff. Now, notice I'm not mentioning anything about the HUD ones. So that's the evidence that they review.
Well, that's the evidence that they put forth, and there was contradictory evidence also.
But the jury chooses, right?
But if you look at the actual counts that they allege, all this evidence comes in as part of this large, this happened, according to them, in 200 different files. But if you look at the counts of conviction that were remaining after the jury found her not guilty, there was no evidence that she cut and pasted those checks. The evidence that was presented at trial in two out of those charged counts, is that a check was given to the Jepsons at Title Zone after the closing, and she accepted a photocopy or a fax. That was all authorized by Title Zone, who actually then got the money. Title Zone already has the money in their accounts, and it's our position that Title Zone is an unindicted co-schemer in this. They have the funds. It's up to them to say, okay, go ahead and write the checks out to the following parties. So it's Title Zone who doesn't care that all the closing documents are there, because they're getting a piece of the pie also. They control the funds after the wire has already taken place. So it's their distribution of those funds which are the proceeds of the scheme. Because what these people were intending to do was to profit off these straw buy closings. I know I'm running out of time, and I wanted to... I'm sorry, Judge, go ahead.
Just one question. Well, what's Title Zone's financial relationship with Ms. Ford, Mr. Sennett?
Ms. Ford worked for Title Zone. She was an employee, Judge.
They paid her commissions, right?
They paid her a set amount per closing. Yeah. What happened is the funds in the HUD statement that go to the closing agent go to Title Zone. Right. They pay her a salary based on that.
Right. Okay.
But, and just to address one other issue, if you look at the transcripts and the testimony on both sides, there's evidence that she's actually calling Title Zone saying, should we close this? This is missing. And they're the ones that say yes, and it's Charles White then who takes a check or a, you know, either an alter check to Title Zone, not to Ms. Ford. The other issue I want to address, Your Honors, in the short period of time that I've left, is the issue of whether or not the court erred in not allowing good character evidence on behalf of Ms. Ford when she testified. During the direct examination of Ms. Ford, we attempted to elicit testimony that she had been approached by the FBI in a different matter, and she was willing to cooperate and work with them. When we tried to raise that argument during our direct, the court sustained the government's objection. Then, after cross-examination by the government, we re-raised the issue, indicating that they had opened the door into this good character evidence that the court denied the first time, and we were denied again on redirect. We believe that that is not harmless error, because if the jury would have heard that, you already know the jury found her not guilty on two of the counts. If the jury would have seen that she had a propensity not to commit this kind of crime, I mean, it was another mortgage fraud case that the FBI had approached her and said, hey, if these people come in for a closing, contact us. She contacts them, similar to what this whole ENHS scheme to defraud is, false mortgage applications for closings. We believe the court erred in not allowing that evidence during the trial, and therefore we'd ask for that reason alone she'd be granted, that the conviction be reversed and she'd get a new trial. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless this court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sannon.
Thank you,
Mr.
Judge.
Mr. Paul.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Brian Fall, here today on behalf of Charles White. Mr. White's appeal focuses primarily on the issues stemming from the admission of the summary chart into evidence during trial and the conversion of that chart to a loss calculation chart at sentencing. It's Mr. White's argument that the summary chart was improperly admitted into evidence and submitted to the jury. The chart was admitted as a summary chart under Federal Rule of Evidence 1006, but it included on the chart four indices that the government believed were indices of fraud. The inclusion of those items on the chart turned that chart from a summary chart into an argumentative chart, something that would be more properly allowed to be testified to under Federal Rule Evidence 611.
What prevented you, if you thought other transactions should have been put before the jury, from doing exactly that? I mean, the government tells the judge, tells everybody what its selection criteria are. Why couldn't you have introduced other things?
The defense counsel could have admitted or brought up all the documents called, witnesses testify about each of the 500 documents in that case. They could have. And the question isn't so much, I believe, there's no question that the government could have this chart and could have used it when examining witnesses and could have used it during closing arguments. The problem is that you have an argumentative summary chart which is admitted into evidence.
I don't see why it's argumentative, though. It has the transactions. I mean, if there have been 1,000 other transactions in which there wasn't a problem, they've gathered together the transactions that they've identified as meeting certain criteria. It's there on the page. The underlying documents are also admitted into evidence. And I don't see why that isn't exactly what the rule is for in 1006.
Well, 1006 says that, you know, it's for evidence that could be, you know, is too voluminous and a chart can be admitted in lieu of that evidence. What this chart did by saying that it indicated that these were fraudulent. The government argued time and time again that these were fraudulent transactions.
The government says that. The chart doesn't say that. The chart just has facts on it. Buyer, seller name, street address, loan amount, mortgage broker, and so on. There are a bunch of things that if they inaccurately represent the underlying documents, that's one thing, but I don't think anyone's saying that.
No, they're not, because those items were in the underlying documents.
Right.
So the fact that they were pulled out separate from this and given their own line item necessarily, that in our belief turns the argument from a purely representative summary chart to something of argument under 611, which we also believe...
Just because it shines a spotlight on these transactions? I don't see where it becomes argumentative if there aren't argumentative facts in them.
But they are. The argument is that these four criteria is what makes all these transactions fraudulent.
Well, but they are criteria. I mean, you could attack the criteria. I mean, the criteria are, you know, the 15,000, 35,000 limits and so forth. Mr. Cosma is on the stand for cross-examination about that, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the summary chart then at sentencing also became the basis for the government's loss calculation. There are a couple problems that Mr. White identified at sentencing about that loss calculation. First of all, Mr. White identified at least 40 transactions listed in the government loss chart that were either straight buy and sell transactions or did not go through foreclosure, calling into question the validity of the chart, such that the district court should have at least made a finding or called into the question or had a hearing on the reliability of the numbers that is reliant for loss in this case. Additionally, Mr. White made an argument that the victims, the homeowners in this case, were not victims. Under Johns, it's clear that the homeowners would be instrumentalities of a fraud against the lenders, but they were in the same position going through foreclosure when they entered the transaction as some of them were when they conclude the transaction. Some of these.
Well, this removed a certain amount of uncertainty for their financial fate. It seems to me the government's theory was that there are multiple victims. The banks are certainly victims, but the homeowners are too, insofar as they get sucked into this scheme, thinking that they're going to fix their credit, thinking that they're going to be able to leverage equity in their house so that they can get back on their feet, and instead they wind up, sometimes even with family members, much worse off than they started out.
Well, but that some of that is the this program established by Eyes Have Not Seen was based on a Fannie Mae program and was compliant with the Illinois Mortgage Rescue Act. The program worked for a number of people. The program was set up to work and give them an opportunity to buy themselves out of debt and give them an opportunity to get land back on their feet. It worked for many people.
Well, if honest numbers had been used throughout, I don't exclude the possibility that something like that might happen. But that isn't the government's theory. It's not what the jury thought.
Right. But
I mean, these inflated appraisal. I mean, the whole thing, we've seen this before.
Right, but the people who came in were facing foreclosure, and when they left, if they didn't successfully complete the program, they were still facing foreclosure. They are in no worse off position than they were before for those homeowners who it's the homeowners that not anybody else that the court calculated as the victims.
Well, the foreclosure becomes a certainty after this because the mortgage amount balloons up quite considerably. So they're much further underwater at the end of this than they were at the beginning.
For some people, but not necessarily. There are other people who successfully completed the program and continue to own their homes to this day.
So how much concrete evidence did Mr. White put before the district court to show lack of injury on the part of some of these folks?
He didn't put very much, Your Honor. He had this list of the 40 transactions, and the 40 transactions that weren't buy and sell. He demonstrated that some of the people, there was a list of a few, who went through this program and didn't suffer loss.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Fall. Ms. Greenwald.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beginning with Mr. Ford's, on Defendant Ford's argument regarding the wire fraud and whether the scheme was complete or not. The only thing I really want to point out on that is that this wasn't charged as a series of individual schemes completed with each wire. This was one large scheme that expanded 1984 and 1985. And the description of the scheme encompassed all kinds of activities, including by Ms. Ford, not just her involvement in the closings, which was critical, but also she herself served as one of the fraud investors and got paid for it, and with the false information on the application, she herself recruited homeowners with the false information. So she was in the thicket of this entirely massive scheme. And each of these wires were in furtherance of the scheme, but not one delineated on this date that was the end of the scheme. The scheme went on for a two-year, 84 and 85. And for all the other reasons stated in our brief, it was not complete. In terms of the good, quote-unquote, good character evidence, first of all, that argument, and we rely on Swan in our brief, that argument was never made in the district court that they were offering it to show some good character trait. It was offered basically to show propensity, just as defense counsel pretty much said to the court here, that because she acted this way on one occasion, she was acting the same here. And the court specifically found that it was not probative on any issue before it and would have been confusing to the jury, and that that is supported by Hill and the case law in this matter, because it's not the proper way to establish reputation evidence, nor was it appropriate to offer specific instances of conduct to show a particular law-abiding trait that was not an element of the crime here. So unless you have any other questions about, or any questions about Ford, I'll move on to White.
My biggest questions have to do with your loss amount calculation.
Okay.
Actually,
yes.
Because
so
it seems to me
Mr.
that's
White.
The thinnest
sure.
part of the government's case.
Sure. So first of all, the summary, I mean, that all does tie into the summary chart and to the chart. Basically, what the government did was from the records of Title Zone, we identified, because the scheme wasn't limited, of course, to these 9 transactions that people testified to. It was a much larger scheme over all this time. So they took the wire fraud, the records that had been obtained from Title Zone that involved 500 transactions. And of those transactions, using the testimony of numerous witnesses about the false aliases used by White, about the $30,000 in equity to get a house into the scheme, about the multiple buyers and lying on the mortgage application saying that you were going to live in each one, which couldn't happen if you were an investor buying multiple properties at the same time, about the false employers. They identified those 200-and-odd transactions that fit those criteria, Ford being the closer, Helton, you know, the down payment checks being sourced back to White or entities associated with him. And then they narrowed it down to those. Having produced that chart at trial and having identified those properties for purposes of sentencing and the loss amount, took those 225 properties and then submitted to the court not just the graph that Your Honors have as part of the PSR, the chart that lists everything, but also the disk that included the underlying records of all those documents that showed both in terms of the records that were in the trial as well as additional records obtained from title companies and from records of county records and everything like that. It was a very detailed analysis, many records supporting it, showed that for the properties that had gone into foreclosure, what that loss amount was. And for the 37, I think it was, properties that where foreclosure was pending, made an approximation. But even taking the ones where you had actual records and there had been a foreclosure amount to set off against the loan amount, which is a method that's been approved by this court and others in terms of the methodology, the numbers were never specifically challenged by defendants in this case to the court in terms of an actual calculation saying this number's wrong or it shouldn't have been calculated this way, except to the extent that they challenged the bundles because many of these mortgages had been sold on. But as the cases we cite in there say, you don't have to identify each particular loss in there. You can look at the start and look at the end and know that in between there were losses that you add up. If you're following me, between the final mortgage holder and the original one.
So did you account for payments that were made to the mortgage lenders during that first year?
That was
year?
Accounted for on there, Your Honor.
How?
It is, may I step to
certainly,
the...
Certainly, yeah.
I did bring my sheet. You know what? It may not be... I know that in the document submitted to the court, it specifically says in our memorandum to the court, I know, and we have a cite in our brief to the exact page, that it was accounted for, that
right.
we took
I mean, you
those,
say
deducted
that,
those amounts out. And
is this in your addendum to the PSI, which actually we were having some trouble
exactly.
getting?
Exactly, Your
is
Honor.
Is that still in the district court, or was that part of the record here?
No, that should be part of the record here. It should be an addendum to the district, to the PSR that came up with the... We supplemented in the district court the actual chart that was introduced at trial, but this mm-hmm. should be as an addendum to the PSR that I trusted was sent up by the district court. If it hasn't been, I can have it because it's definitely part of the record.
Okay.
But, you know, all of that's under seal.
No, I understand. But we need to look at it.
In terms of where it is accounted for monthly payment, I think that I know that it is accounted for. I can't tell you exactly where
okay.
in here. If I could file
That's
something
right.
with the court after this, because I know it's a factual matter that is definitely in here, and with your permission, I will file something today that tells you exactly where that is.
That would be helpful, yeah.
But I definitely know that it is accounted for, and I'll tell you exactly how in these calculations it is by reference to the record. But that definitely was. So what was left here were the amounts that that was left over after after those payments had been made.
Okay.
So in terms of the loss calculation itself, the court was taken through step by step in both our memorandum as well as the disk that was submitted that had all the underlying documents. And as I say, that specific calculation was never challenged as opposed to the analysis that was used, like were the, you know, the bundling of the loans. And right. There was an allegation made, and I do have to say, I know we cite it in our brief, but there was an allegation, definitely, made, Your Honor is correct, that we didn't account for the monies had been paid, mm-hmm. but we did. Okay. So, and then you come out with a number that even excluding the properties that were not yet in foreclosure, that you couldn't have final foreclosure numbers on, that was far in excess of $7 million. So that, looking then at those properties, that was just extra gravy to make it even safer that it was over that threshold. In terms of the 40 transactions, to be perfectly honest, I've never quite understood that allegation. It was just, in the district court, it was just listed. These are buys and sells, and there was a list of those properties. So I did go through them, checking them against here. If what you mean is that they didn't go into foreclosure for some of them, that is true. And for those that didn't, there wasn't a loss amount assessed. In this list, you'll notice for some properties there isn't a loss amount listed. And that's because sometimes there wasn't a loss. I mean, the government readily concedes that for some properties there was not a loss, either because there was a subsequent resale or the foreclosure amount did cover the loss. Or whatever. And so, and sometimes for those 37 properties that hadn't gone into foreclosure, we didn't have an exact number then. Some of them fit into that. But what it doesn't mean is that it wasn't part of the fraud. Because if you go through this list, and I did for each of those properties they identified on the sheet, almost all of them have multiple indicators of the fraud, where White supplied the down payment, where one of those employers that was a false employer or false amounts was used. That White's alias, one of the aliases, was used. That Ford was the closer. You know, a number of the indicia, not just one or two. And so I'm not sure how it follows that just because there wasn't a financial loss, maybe in some situations, that doesn't mean it wasn't part of the fraud and wasn't relevant to the inquiry.
The scheme, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
but
I thought
it
the information
added a number.
Yeah.
I mean, for most of those properties that they identified, when I look on here, maybe it was like under 1,000 that was even added mm-hmm. to those kind of numbers, and maybe that's what they're getting at. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had any other specifics. I want to make sure I address them on the when you ask about the loss. If there was any other specific question on that.
Well, I mean, as usual, or as is common, there's a lot of extrapolation in the judge's effort to come up with a loss figure. And I guess the other thing I'm always interested in is how close to one of the boundaries in the guidelines are we? This is the 7 to 20 million.
So it was around, using just the properties for which we had numbers that have been foreclosed, it was over 8 million. I don't remember as I stand here the exact number, but it's in our brief, but it was definitely mm-hmm. over 8 million. Mm-hmm. Now, that didn't include the ones that hadn't gone, the 37 that hadn't gone through foreclosure yet that we did some extrapolations on and, you know, then cut it by 50. And also getting to that, the over 7 million, I think we give a margin of error on that.
The judge
we cut
had discounted
that amount.
A couple
you know what
of
I mean?
Times,
we discount even on that
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
But then it also doesn't include you know, harm or whatever to the homeowners, which, you know, we never went through specific equity amounts there and stuff like that, but given the volume of how many there are and, you know, if you were going to try and quantify their losses, it doesn't take into account the loss to numerous investors who maybe, while not victims of the scheme, were certainly victims of the relevant conduct. So, I mean, I feel like we're really quite beyond that 7 million threshold, mm-hmm. Though I can't pinpoint exact numbers over that 8 million number. And I think that's what the court was understanding too. And the court, in detail, went through what their arguments were, what our arguments were, had the documents before it, and his reasoning didn't repeat all of that, but said, looking on this record, having sat through this trial, examining it, the government's figures represent a reasonable estimation. I cannot give you an exact number, but they're a reasonable estimation.
So do you want to comment on, I think it's Mr. Fall's argument, that the homeowners themselves are actually not really even victims, but it's the lenders?
Well, this case is very different than John's. In John's, the homeowners actually agreed to give up, at least most of them had agreed to give up their property. You know, they knew the deal. They were in on the deal. These homeowners were not. They were clearly vulnerable. Under John's, there's no question there's vulnerable. The question would be about, you know, the harm and the pecuniary harm, the other injury. In this case, we have homeowners who were, I believe, as Your Honors pointed out, gave up the right to their home. Whatever, though, they were going to go into foreclosure, there was a right, an interest in that home, and maybe working out other deals in that home that they weren't able to pursue because they, you know, maybe a more legitimate rescue plan that they weren't able to put into place because they had this. Then some of them were taken into bankruptcy, which seems to be, was part of another way to milk money out of this, as well as to, you know, kind of feel like they were doing something for them in terms of way fixing their credit, but in fact it put them in an even worse position and certainly made it sure they weren't going to get their homes back at the end of it. And in addition, they also did face a situation where their mortgage payments on their home at the end were now much higher than when they'd started. So were there harm to these people? As the judge said and made a finding, I've sat here through this trial and I've listened to person after person, and you can read in the transcript people are breaking down on the stand. They're crying. They've lost the homes that they inherited from their families. The judge said, yes, these people were more in a hole than they were when they started with you, and you knew that was going to happen. You knew they were going to have higher mortgages. You knew they were selling. You were selling their house. You knew bankruptcy wasn't repairing their credit. So were they harmed? Yes, very differently than the fact situation in John's.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Greenwald.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I will get that that letter to the court today.
Right. Mr. Fall?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just speak briefly to the list of 40 transactions that Mr. White offered. Those 40 transactions, he believes, is evidence that there's questions about whether or not the transactions listed on the chart are actually fraudulent. Sentencing counsel, who was not trial counsel, came on and found 40 transactions that, although they meet the government's indices of fraud, involve no loss. It called into question, you know, each of these should be examined. That just because they met these four criteria does not necessarily mean they're fraudulent. And he demonstrated that a number of them resulted either in were straight buy and sell transactions, or there were no foreclosures. And in that demonstrates that that some of these weren't fraudulent, and therefore the whole thing should be questioned. Such that, you know, if the court is going to accept this loss amount, it should give more than a one-paragraph summary of why it's accepting the loss amount, and that's all it was, one paragraph.
Did the defense offer a counter figure suggesting that these 40 would reduce the amount by X?
They did not, Your Honor. And
don't you think that might have been appropriate, because you could determine that, could you not? They were 40 specific instances, Mr. Fall, as you suggest.
Right, and the sentencing counsel made a number of other arguments that kind of included this numbers and others, and because I guess sentencing counsel's argument was that it's too convoluted to come up with a one number that, you know, we need to take this apart and we need to, you know.
Well, that's my point. If his argument is you've got to break apart what's represented by the government is their bottom line number.
No,
it seems to me you've got to have something to subtract.
No, they didn't attempt to disprove it. They just had a problem with the proof that the government offered. And then turning to the just quickly to the counsel's argument about the vulnerable victims, talking about maybe they foreclosed other opportunities. There was no evidence of that, that there was another mortgage foreclosure program available to them. There was no evidence in the record that they decided to choose Eyes Have Not Seen over some other program to save them. They were in foreclosure before, and they ended up in foreclosure afterwards. For that reason, but we don't challenge the vulnerability, but we challenge that they're victims.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Thank you.
Sam?
You know, just briefly commenting on what the government said about this overreaching scheme. They didn't charge an overreaching conspiracy to commit mail fraud. What they charged in 7 counts that relate to Ms. Ford, because there were other counts relating to Mr. Helton, is a scheme that on such and such a date a wire or mail fraud took place. That's the actual charged conduct under 1343 and 1342. So there is an end date to that charge. Their argument is, well, they did it again on another day. Well, that's a separate charged incident based on maybe some of the same facts. But in each one of them, there's an end when the proceeds or the money at the closing is sent from, let's say, New York with one of the banks over to Jepson, who is a co-consumer who the evidence is clear was working with Mr. White. So at that point, that specific act charged crime, let's say in count one, which Ms. Ford was found guilty of, is complete. The proceeds then being divvied up to Eyes Have Not Seen, to the closing attorney, to whoever else is on this HUD, is the distribution of the money that was obtained from the fraud. And for those reasons, there wasn't Ms. Ford's work in this closings are not relevant to the actual scheme itself. And for those reasons, we believe her conviction should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Sannon. Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. Sannon, you were appointed in this case, and you have the court's thanks for ably representing Ms. Ford. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.